who is the Gund Curatorial Fellow at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Cleveland, and Amanda D. King, who's an artist and activist and has a law degree as well. And I'm speaking with them today from Cleveland to discuss several events that have happened in Cleveland recently in the museum world, and also what their own projects are. Well, first of all, hello and welcome.
Hi.
So the institution that you work for, LaTanya, you're there on a two-year fellowship, is that right?
Yeah, so I'm getting my PhD in art history. I study photography, I study landscapes, I study museums, I study critical race, how it operates throughout museum culture. And I am doing my dissertation on lynching memorials.
And you're a second-time guest on Live Culture because I looked it up. It's been 3 years now, but you were curatorial fellow at the Yale University Art Gallery, and I interviewed you during your exhibit, Let Us March On, which was three years ago now. So listeners to Live Culture can find the podcast for that in the archive on SoundCloud. So welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for reaching out again. Thank you, Martha.
And you and Amanda, did you know each other before?
You know, I'm new to Cleveland. I moved here for fellowship and met Amanda, but maybe Amanda, I know you're there too. Do you want to, I feel weird. It's like we haven't said hello to Amanda.
Hello, Amanda.
Hello, everyone. How are you?
Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I think I met Amanda early in my time when I arrived in Cleveland last year. So we started talking more around the time when I started putting together my exhibition that's up right now at MoCA Cleveland called Temporary Spaces of Joy and Freedom. And Amanda was one of these artists here in town that I really admire. And I'm looking for ways to connect with local artists and people who do important work. And so, yeah, I think when the show opened here, I reached out to definitely invite her to be part of the activities and stuff for the exhibition. But we were talking before then too. I just can't remember when we really started.
You did a studio visit for my residency at Caramel House.
It was like in the summer, right?
Yeah. So that was interesting. So yeah, I mean, I totally respect LaTanya's work and was looking forward to having a Black woman curator in a space like MoCA. That was really important to me. I'm always looking. I'm navigating these cultural spaces constantly as an artist and as the creative director of an artistic activism organization that is in some ways a holistic pipeline to the creative economy, right?
And that organization is, you're referring to Shooting Without Bullets?
Shooting Without Bullets, yes. And so I'm constantly interfacing with cultural institutions. And so to have someone like LaTanya who uses frameworks and pedagogy that are resistant to the dominant institutional narratives and practices, that was very important for me to connect with her and to build relationship. And certainly this ideological tension between the exhibition, MoCA choosing to exhibit the work of Sean Leonardo.
Oh yeah, okay, so we'll go into that in a second.
Okay.
Because I think that listeners may not know about that, but just, I wanted you to give, if possible, a short soundbite about what Shooting Without Bullets is, because it's really interesting.
Sure, so Shooting Without Bullets is an artistic activism organization. We utilize cultural production, artist education and development, activism and advocacy to model an alternative arts ecosystem that accelerates movement that Black and Brown youth and their communities need to thrive. Mm-hmm. As a part of that organization, our nonprofit structure houses the engagement with young people ages 13 through 21 and their communities. But then we also run a social enterprise, which is a creative agency and production company that actually provides creative services to clients who are interested in social justice. And the young people in our organization are the interns and problem solvers for the creative agency.
That's great. That's great. So the reason that I contacted you both initially was that I was seeing a fair amount of news when the director of MoCA Cleveland stepped down, Jill Snyder, and she issued an apology, and it had to do with an exhibit by an artist named Sean Leonardo, which was canceled. And the exhibit called The Breath of Empty Space was due to open in June, and a couple months before that they canceled it. And of course museums plan exhibits, you know, well in advance, and this is a traveling exhibit that had gone to, it was in Maryland for instance recently, but it includes images of violence and police brutality, police killings. So it had images of Eric Garner, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, and Rodney King. But the real issue was that Cleveland, of course, is where Tamir Rice was killed. and Miss Rice, Tamir's mother, objected to this, and a number of other people in the community objected to it, and the museum canceled the exhibit based on that. And then after that happened, Mr. Leonardo accused the museum of white fragility and racism in turn on their part for not offering him a chance to speak to the community. Both of you had been talked to by the museum, and Amanda, you work with Miss Rice as a consultant for her, but you were involved in giving her voice. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I was approached by the museum. They were basically giving a courtesy email saying that this show was coming up. Mm-hmm. Let us know if this is of interest to you.
Is that normal? A courtesy email of that sort?
I receive a bunch of weird emails. So, okay. In my line of work, artistic activism, I do get weird emails like that.
Okay. All right.
But it was a courtesy email. It was an email that said, hey, we're doing this thing. The show was already in motion when Mocha informed me of this work. And actually, the irony of that is that the email referenced an article about, basically about Miss Rice creating her own pedagogy for how she would work with artists who are representing Tamir. Mm-hmm. And in the title of the article is, We Need to Tell a Different Story.
Right.
And it talked about the work of the Astor Gates, Michael Rakowitz.
Right.
At that time, we were working with E.J. Hill on the University of St. Tamir, where Miss Rice's words were included directly in the exhibition on a lectern. And so it was talking about how all of these artists are engaging around Tamir Rice's murder, but they're telling something new from what the media coverage was saying, from what the court docket was communicating, from what anti-Black institutions were representing Tamir as. And so it was very ironic that this reductive and decontextualized show was why they were contacting us, and that article, and somehow they didn't understand that this show was absolutely contradictory to what this article was talking about.
Because Mr. Leonardo's work uses their charcoal drawings, but they're based on news footage and police camera photography. It's really about the media itself.
Yes, it's about the media itself, and it's about the last moment of any of these boys and men's lives, or the most traumatic moment of their lives, if they survived.
Miss Rice was quite clear about this. And as a mother, I believe that she has the right to not want to see images of her child put up in a museum as works of art in quite this way. You had talked, Latanya, about the concept of a scaffold of care, which was not in place. I want to talk about that, and also how what happened next was that the museum has apologized to Sean Leonardo several times, and they haven't been very clear about who they spoke to and who in the community wasn't happy about this. And I'm unsure why exactly, but they made it sound like it was a secret. There was an article that interviewed both of you locally that talked about how you were anonymous, and that didn't seem to be quite fair, because in fact, you'd been asked by the museum your opinion on these things. Is that right?
No, they never asked my opinion on anything. The point. So
that's just weird.
Yeah. I mean, I started at Mocha in March 2019. And like, I was saying, my background is I'm working on my PhD on lynching memorials. Before that, I did my master's on lynching postcards as a form of American landscape, the racist landscape that we live in. And I also did my honors thesis as a bachelor for my bachelor's degree on lynching imagery too. So I have a longstanding background of studying lynching and then I also study how race operates in institutions, like I said, and all of these. And nobody mentioned the show to me at all, actually. So my boss at the time is Chief Curator Courtney Finn. She never mentioned what the images were. I really learned about the show maybe in the summer, and it was just a title. I didn't know what the work was. We were just told the general theme is police brutality is what I was told. And that was it. And I never learned what the work was. And I didn't come to learn anything about it really until Amanda reached out and asked me in January. So that's why I keep thinking of January. But yeah, we had met before. But in January, Amanda was like, why is the museum showing this?
And this is when it was up in Maryland. So it was already mean, very visible. You could look at it online in Maryland and see.
Yeah, I guess. With View at MICA in Maryland. But I didn't know anything about it. And like I said, none of this had been presented. I've worked in the curatorial department, and none of it was presented to the curatorial department, and of course not to everybody else in the museum. It's only, I guess, the chief curator, deputy director, and the director really knew what the images were, I suppose. I don't really know because I wasn't part of any of that.
Do you think this is because they had as I understand it, the real curator of the exhibit was an outside independent curator?
Do I think that's why they didn't present it to people?
Yeah. Was it because it was a sort of outside thing that they were bringing?
They don't present a lot of things that, you know, I think it's just a case of how they manage exhibitions.
Okay.
So, you know, even exhibitions we're preparing, it doesn't seem to be a standard routine of presenting the materials ahead of time. That happens in some institutions. It's not happening at MoCA. Yeah, it's an outside independent curator who also had affiliation, used to work at MoCA, I believe, years ago. Yeah. I don't know him at all, but I think he did. But anyway, I don't think that was the reason why they didn't present it. I just think it was probably just, it just didn't happen in the shuffle, and that's not a practice at MoCA. But anyway, yeah, I wasn't involved in any of it until Amanda asked me to look at the imagery and asked me what I thought of it. And then I looked into it and did have serious questions and concerns about that material, and just the package didn't cite any kind of scholarship really on this material. And thinking about scaffoldings of care is an expression I got really from an article or discussion between Leanne Batasmasaki Simpson. She's this Mishisagat Anishinaabe scholar, activist, artist, living up in the area now known as Toronto, Canada, or in that area. And she's in conversation with Dionne Brand, who is this really important Caribbean Canadian scholar and poet. And so they had this really wonderful conversation, and in there Leanne says that Indigenous and Black folks are, as activists, are often on the front lines for freedom, and they experience violence in ways that, like, they get hit first. And we need to make sure, as Indigenous and Black communities, need to make sure to try to build in scaffoldings of care, so certain kind of networks to catch those people who get hit first, and to make sure that we care for our communities. So I thought that was, you know, of course, is a really beautiful and wonderful feeling that she's sharing in there, and that really just kind of resonated with me. And I think about that in terms of my curatorial practice and working in these institutions. I work, you know, like MoCA is predominantly white institution, and I've worked at, you know, Yale. So, you know,
yeah.
I've got experience working in these PWIs, so to say. And as the only Black person, and often the only person of color, like at MoCA, the only person of color who is developing, creating exhibitions and programming, I try to, in my own work, create networks of care. And so when I saw that in their discussion that Leanne had, when she was using that expression, scaffoldings of care, it was just something I latched onto, and I think it makes sense. So yeah, I think anytime you're going to, if someone's interested in that type of material, and, you know, I think if one is, should have a lot of reasoning why, and that there was no reasoning why, it's nothing. But it's just, this is a show that these other people want to do. That was what I was told by Courtney Finn. This is a show that the director is interested in, the deputy director is interested in. And so she was just going to make it happen. And she told me just to read the artist statement when I asked her questions about why is it happening. A curator's role is to have a responsibility for anything that's on view.
Yes.
It's not about, right, you know, it's not about like this artist made it and this is what they say. Artists can make whatever they want. And everybody knows, of course, that very few things make it into collections. Very few things make it into exhibition. That's just how it is, right? Mm-hmm. And so as a curator, that's what I know as a curator. It's our job to make decisions. And you are thinking about why you're putting on certain kind of content, why this place, why now, why this art, who would this affect? Like, all of these questions had not been asked, actually. And so that raised a lot of red flags to me. And yeah, I thought about it in terms of basic job of a curator. And then, of course, what the subject material is, those highly volatile and problematic kind of, to me, very problematic kind of imagery. I mean, I don't see how you could say it's not. It is. Violent imagery, right?
Very violent.
And this idea of the looking, and I think it's supposed to create some type of empathetic identification kind of process. But there's been many scholars, like key folks, right? Like Saidiya Hartman, this really brilliant thinker who is a MacArthur fellow who wrote this book. She wrote many wonderful books, but one I'm just going to think with right now is Scenes of Subjection. And then it has a subtitle, but it's about 19th century images. And she's talking about slavery. And she has a whole chapter where she talks about people doing this kind of looking into these kind of violent images of Black death, of Black bodies being tortured, and how that looking is often, it can really lead to kind of a pornographic possibility. And she talks about, like, what does it mean to, for the fact that we think that white viewers can't understand the pain of others unless they can imagine themselves as that, is that person being victimized, is that person being killed. They have to project themselves into that Black body, because otherwise they can't actually care about Black people. They can only do it through erasing the Black body. So there's like in her book, there's a whole section on that. And I was like, wow, like, you know, my brain was just popping. And of course, none of that is mentioned. I mean, like, if this is the material and this person is gonna, you know, they're making this, they should be contending. They should know this scholarship that's been out for like over 20 years. And then of course, Christina Sharpe's work, I work very closely with. She's this author of this book that really, to me, is kind of, basically, people say it's a reference book. It's called In the Wake on Blackness and Being. Mm-hmm. And she talks about violent images of Black people and anti-Blackness, the prevalence of anti-Blackness in this society. And that as scholars, as artists, it's just people who care, we have to create ways to care for Black people. And I center that in my curatorial practice. So when I ask questions about the show, I ask those basic curatorial kind of questions. And I also ask questions about how we were going to care for community members who would come into the show, and also our staff. I mean, it's telling, like I just said, that I'm the only Black person, only person of color who's developing any content in this museum in a majority Black city. So that lets you know a lot about like what the dynamics are probably like in that institution. We do not have a space in that institution that is caring and that is really doing the work of anti-racism and equity. So yes, I was thinking definitely about, there are some Black staff, not many, not in jobs that they get to develop the programs, they get to develop and pick exhibitions.
Right.
They don't have that kind of capacity at that institution.
And the whole issue of the kind of pornographic viewing of usually police tapes really came to a head with George Floyd's murder in May. They, all over the internet, people were posting, and most of the time it was men to be empathetic or to decry it as murder, but at the same time, it was very, very upsetting to many people to not be able to go on social media without constantly seeing these images reiterated over and over and over again. The repetition of it, the amount that we see it. It's not like one of the articles that I think it was talking to you, Amanda, about Andy Warhol's images taken from the news. And at the time that Warhol was making his paintings, we didn't have the sort of, it seemed like a lot at the time. He was making the images because it seemed like there was sort of endless car crashes and electrocutions and things like that. But actually, it's accelerated so much more since then.
And you know, that doesn't even say, of course, that, you know, again, with the pornographic viewing, is it fortunately, insanely, but not, I guess it's not surprising, with the George Floyd murder, there were white teenagers and white young people who were taking that video, and then they had a thing they called the George Floyd Challenge, where they would pretend that they were killing their friend, and they would actually have videos on TikTok where they pressed their knee into someone's neck, and they made videos and were posting that stuff. So that happens all the time. People keep emulating the things and having it as a joke,
right?
Because they are racist. So yeah, that whole narrative of like, let's look at this and let's spend time staring at Black bodies that are destroyed, because that way we're going to do something. I mean, so many scholars have highlighted how that does not happen, really. We have had Elizabeth Alexander said something wonderful. I don't have it in front of me, but basically looking at tortured and killed Black bodies is an American pastime. We've been doing it since the beginning. That's what slavery is. We've had people on the auction block. They separate mothers and from their children on the auction block. White people watch that. it didn't make them change and become better human beings. They watched our bodies being destroyed. They watched people being separated. They were consuming that because that's what they believe is the right order of things.
From the museum's perspective, they canceled the show. And then they say that they interviewed another section of the Black community and other people were not against the idea of the show. And Mr. Leonardo says that he was not given the chance to talk to the community. And that seems odd to me because Miss Rice is upset that he didn't communicate with her at all. And the show is made up of works that have already been completed that are making the rounds right now. And he could have contacted her on his own. It seems to me that his work and the subject matter of his work, it's not up to the museum to introduce him to the survivors. It would be up to him as an artist to do that. This is his project, his work. You know, it's his obligation. Not the museum should have done more, but they didn't. But really, as an artist, it does seem to me that it's on him. And what he says is, what I take the most offense to, and this is from the New York Times article, is that the museum leadership was using my work to create the opening for a dialogue that should have been happening in the first place. So would you agree with that? It probably should have been happening in the first place, the dialogue. But it seemed to me that his work was supposed to be about creating a dialogue.
It's complicated. So
I think it is complicated, yeah.
I first start with Ms. Rice's perspective. Like mm-hmm. I told you, she had developed this pedagogy for working with artists
right.
to represent Samir in the totality of who he was as a 12-year-old boy and not just relegating his existence to the final moment where he was brutally shot by the police at a recreation center where he was playing, right? Like Tamir is a son, he's a brother, he was a classmate, he was a student, and he was an aspiring artist. And so throughout every single work, there is a reference to the being of Tamir, the soul of Tamir, even the gazebo where he was murdered. Mm-hmm. It is a space of reflection and contemplation. And with Michael Rakovich and the orange object, thinking about the color orange and the orange tip and having Miss Rice contribute to that and EJ's work, she is very clear about, I am the original source. I know everything about Tamir. I am mother and I am witness to what happened. So why wouldn't you just come to me? Why are you taking media reports that are skewed? Why are you taking court documents where you know there was no justice served because there wasn't even a simple indictment? People say it's very easy to indict even a ham sandwich, but we couldn't indict the murder of a 12-year-old boy.
Right.
You know, so like it's this, why are you not going to Ms. Rice, who is in the media, who, you know, she started the Tamir Rice Foundation. She's building the Afrocentric Cultural Center. There are tens and dozens of articles on this. She is not inaccessible.
Mm-hmm.
So for artists to continue to make work about Tamir and never once reach out to her in the process.
The exhibit is coming to specifically to the place where he was murdered.
Yes.
Right?
And that's true. But she's talking about when the artist made this work in 2016, she yeah. should have been the first person that he contacted to, not because you're coming to my city now and about to show this work, all of a sudden you want to engage with me. That's unacceptable. But then there's other issues beneath that, which is this artist practicing an ethics of care? Are they being ethical at all? Are they doing a balancing test of their right to artistic expression and the potential harm to others? Mm-hmm. In this case, it was Miss Rice and her family, someone appropriating this very violent image of her son to invoke empathy from white people who continuously rain terror on Black folks and communities, and it's happening right here in present day Cleveland. The potential harm to the Cleveland community, who is dealing with very real threats of police violence. We are still under a consent decree where right. the Cleveland Division of Police are working with the Department of Justice for more accountability because they've engaged in a pattern and practice of unconstitutional policing. And then the potential harm to young people who are the age of Tamir Rice, who yeah. are the age of Michael Brown, who the museum are inviting into the space to get their numbers up and their diversity quotas. These young people are seeing the lives of their peers
very decontextualized. And the reality of life for them is their lives are in regards to decontextualized. We're not seeing them as whole beings. They're never represented in their fullness and their totality. And so to go into the museum and to see these charcoal drawings of fragmented Black boys and men at these horrific moments, what does that internally do to these young people's mind but to say that you deserve to be neglected, brutalized, that this is the norm? That is not care. And so I think that the artist should have known that there is immense sensitivity to this, and that to sort of creating a method to represent Blackness, to appropriate the white gaze in that, to like we said, invoke empathy at the expense of Black and brown people who are seeing this brutality daily is reckless. Even if you're trying to expose the horrors of it, what you are doing to those most affected is further violence.
So I wanted to read two quotes, one from the hyperallergic article from Ms. Rice, because I think they're really poignant. Who wants to see the death of their loved one, their child, in an art show? Really? I don't find that too appealing to the eye, Rice reflected in her conversation with Hyperallergic. Who would want to use the image of a 12-year-old being murdered as art? That's no type of art for me. That's the last image I have of my son, period. And another one is, she said to the artist, should have reached out to me and talked to me about his ideas. Addressing herself rhetorically to Leonardo, she said, you're not going to benefit off my son's death. When I first read the article about Jill Snyder stepping down, I thought that that was the right reaction. But I also thought that canceling the show was the right reaction. Then I read the New York Times article, which was all about how the show had been canceled and they were going to show the art, and that he was in fact the victim in this. And that's kind of how it seems to be being posited now. There's two apologies on the website, or there's been two formally issued apologies. And a lot of it centers on the fact that he wasn't given a chance to speak to the community himself.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, it doesn't highlight the work that they didn't do in the first place, because the story starts the year before. And that's been, you know, purposely hidden and obscured to talk about what they didn't do. And the focus became all on, well, the concerns from community members and some staff or whatever, that happened later. But it's like, the reality is there was a disavowal of some curatorial responsibility in the first place.
Yes.
Some stuff that should have happened. And if that work was considered important to put out, then there should have been a conversation before it got put on the schedule. There should have been a conversation, all those questions, of course, about why this work, what does it have, that why we need to show it here now. And of course, we have to remember those images are of other people too, who have families.
Yes.
We're talking only because it's here in Cleveland, but all of those people have families. Those are contemporary individuals who were just murdered and identified through the art.
Beloved,
pictures, which is still problematic, and you can still talk about the ethics of it, showing pictures of people from the 19th century who have been dead for a while, but showing pictures of anyone that has been killed in the last 5-6 years, images like that of contemporary individuals, these aren't pictures of people from the 19th century. That's still got an ethical concern in that, about showing those kind of images as, you know, for aesthetic pleasure or whatever, for the aesthetic experience. But images of contemporary people within the last 5 to 20 years, because the Rodney King, named individuals in one's artwork, you know, you are, like, to me as a curator, as an artist, you just know you're stepping in a certain arena, a certain territory. And I think the responsibility of the curator, I mean, I think the artist has an ethical and moral responsibility. And interesting to see is that just last year, another artist, Andrea Bauer, incorporated some images of a rape victim in one of her pieces. And, you know, she had whatever her intentions were that were, I think, good. She did that without permission. And that victim happened to see the images of herself in the artwork, right? And in that case, the person, it was also attached to the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. And that person, you know, was very upset about the artist doing that. And the artist, with prodding, I believe, but I don't know how much, did agree that she should not have put those images in her artwork without permission, you know, ethically and morally, that she shouldn't. And she removed them. So I think it's really interesting. And I don't think that person ended up becoming, you know, getting some kind of public shaming about censoring or anything. And so I think it's very interesting in this case where the victims are Black and there becomes this discussion of, you know, the whole conversation has been shifted so much and directed towards anyone questioning the ethic and the morality of this is the problem, but not the fact that we're not even looking back to the curatorial responsibility that was, you know, not taken on in the first place by the institution. And just even ethically and you know, morally, what's up with that? And then the thing about a victim's family member is calling, you know, questioning that material too. And we're not even hearing the voices of the other family members. I mean, that's not part of this discussion as well. So this is a much more complicated issue and one that I think involves like just museums in general, who's in charge, who's making the decisions, our art world, what is consumed as some type of aesthetic experience. Whose life does matter, right? Whose life does matter is really at the crux of all of this. Who can be consumed visually and it be considered, it's just necessary for us to see Black destroyed body.
But
why is that necessary?
Good question. But I want to go back a little bit to the 19th century and talk about history painting for just a second, because I think there's the problem of the construction of history comes in here as well. So you've got the problem of exploiting a very real person's image and their agony. And as you're the expert on lynching images, so you can correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but one of the things about lynching images in general is the way that they dehumanize the person too, that the person being lynched has their humanity basically taken away from them.
It's complicated. I would say basically in the first place, lynching in itself is dehumanization.
Well, yeah.
Images that are made are also a form of the violence. They are violent as well.
Mm-hmm.
Those images were made typically for the consumption of a white racist public. So the images itself are violent.
Right.
So it's not a separation.
You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and streaming online at WPKN.org. This is Live Culture with Martha Willett Lewis, and this month I'm in conversation with artist and activist Amanda D. King and curator and activist LaTanya S. Autry. Please join us as we resume the conversation.
So with history painting as a general construct, like Napoleon, paintings of Napoleon or George Washington crossing the Delaware or all of these other scenes, you get something that's being memorialized by an artist that's supposed to be sort of timeless and hang up in a place like a museum forever. And then there's all the problematics of who doesn't make it into history and whose stories are not being told. So on one hand, if you don't put the most important issues of the day somewhere in the art, there's a problem. And if you do, and you do it wrong, that's a problem.
Well, can I chime in here? In the context of these egregious scenes of Black and brown boys and men being murdered by the police, there's another implication here that is legal.
Yeah.
Many of the cases are still open. Many of these cases are, their families are seeing, you know, maybe justice wasn't served on the local level, so they're reaching to the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
Representations like this, they can create bias in a juror if they saw it, in
sure.
a judge if they saw it. They can spread miscommunication. The representation of Tamir was very vague. It was a representation of Tamir after he was shot. And so what happens is the police car in the charcoal drawing obscures Tamir's body, which at that point would be laying on the ground bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows the two police officers securing the premise. And the two police officers have their guns pointed towards each other, actually, because one's in the front of the car, one's in the back. So they're surrounding the car, trying to surround the premise where the body of young Tamir is laying on the ground bleeding. And so if you look at the image, because of the sizing, one police officer is very small, the other is very large. They're both pointing guns at each other.
Mm-hmm.
The first thought in your mind could be very, very well be that this is Tamir Rice pointing a firearm at the police officer. And there's no, that's not by happenstance or just, oh, I just chose this moment.
No, no, no.
The tension that the artist wanted for people to have and mm-hmm. wanted people to talk about, well, is that the boy? Is that the officer? And that's a distraction from the point that we need to abolish the police system that is constantly creating genocide in Black community. It doesn't matter who is pointing the gun, what minute, what second. We do not need to be depicting this institution as anything but something that should be dead. And this work in this, let's create dialogue around
whether, you know, this killing of this boy was right, or what are the little details that we need to flesh out for our own understanding. No, if you are taking representations of these boys and men, you better be making a statement. The artist neutrality on this issue and the decontextualization around it shows that you're not taking a stance. And if you're not taking a stance, then you are anti-Black. I just must say that, because this issue is very real. Ms. Rice's pain is very real.
Yeah.
The Black and brown youth in these communities who are constantly faced with the police, who feel like their lives are in danger at every moment, this is real. There is no debate, but how do we end this system? And if you're depicting this system and wanting people to look at the ins and out and figure, get away from the empathy to the dismantling, period.
Well said. To me, one of the things that really struck me was the gender issues here too. I noticed that it's women standing up. The other thing that I've also been noticing is there's been a lot of issues involving race and museums. And LaTanya, you have an entire organization about that. But there's been a lot of directors stepping down, and they tend to be white women. So I was curious about how gender fit into all of these things. This is probably too big a
yeah, I mean, that's like a class.
That's like a class right there, right?
Yeah, but yeah, definitely, you know, like, I'm actually using hair is central to my, I'm calling it decolonial abolitionist curatorial praxis now. Uh-huh. And I really developed that through thinking with the scholarship of a lot of people, but a lot of women in particular who focus care in their work, a collective care, a care for the people who are most oppressed in our society, as Amanda is talking about. That's the care I'm thinking about. If you care yeah. about the people at the bottom, then you care about everybody, the people who are most experiencing oppression. So the scholarship that I'm thinking with, you know, I mentioned Leanne Batas-Masaki Simpson and Dion Brand and Christina Sharp and Saidiya Hartman, all women scholars, right?
Yeah.
And of course we do. We've got women out here. Women, it's so interesting, especially Black women have done so much kind of important care work in their theory, in their practice, and care is central in a lot of what we do, actually, I think. And it's really, I have to say, just infuriating to be kind of attacked for doing that work, for caring for communities who are most oppressed, and then be talked down to by the people who do not know the scholarship, by the people who you know who do not care about these communities.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they're in these positions of power. And that's because, yes, museums, it's not a coincidence that we keep seeing racism being highlighted recently in museums and is a real problem. That is actually the foundation. That's the foundation of museums, is colonialism and racism. Anti-Blackness is just, that's standard for museums. That's what they're about. That's their origins and that's their ongoing practices. Racism is just what these institutions pretty much are. And if you're not out there seriously trying to fight it in a real active, open way, as Amanda is talking about, as with artists, but if you're not doing that in museums, then you're just contributing to the same thing. You are the same thing.
Museums are not known for their openness anyway. So recently, MOCAD, the director, Alicia Borowy Reeder, just stepped down in Detroit. That one was not for a particular exhibit that had to do with just a history of abuse and racism. And then also at the Guggenheim, there was a Basquiat exhibit that was curated by a Black curator who was oddly not invited to a panel talk about the exhibit itself, not included, basically shut out of her own exhibit. And the exhibit was given a sort of form of benign neglect where they didn't promote it.
Right, that's Pedro LaBouvier. And Black yeah. women have been, Black women are on the front lines all the time, calling out the racism of these institutions. It's not too many other people who are brave enough to do it, especially who work in the museums. Very, very few call out the racism when they work in the institution. And Shiedra is one of the few who's done it. And yeah, she called out all that stuff at the Guggenheim. And the Guggenheim sent his house. She was talking about that stuff last year and before. This year, a group of curators put together a letter, but an anonymous letter, you know, where yeah. they signed and highlighted about how the institution is enabling racism, I believe. But nobody put their name on it. It's people in the field know what's going on in museums.
Yeah.
People know it's racist. If you don't know it and you work in museums, you know, that's probably because you're just benefiting from it and just denying that it's happening. But most people know it. Most people will never speak up about it. And so many people get burned. And it's, like I said, it's the Black women who will speak out. And
right.
they get burned over and over again. And they do not get supported by the arts community and by the museum community. society. Other people benefit from the labor that we do. It's racism and it's the gender violence. It's a misogynoir that's happening, actually.
Yes, misogynoir. That's a nice turn of phrase. I like it. So oddly, Sean Leonardo's attorney, Robert Cosgrove, discussed the fact that they had taken down the image of Tamir. The attorney said, Sean's art presents important issues in nuanced and challenging ways. We're working with the Rice family's attorneys to ensure that artistic expressions of newsworthy events can be undertaken. Now, that kind of language is really problematic to me because, again, it's depersonalizing Tamir, and he's a newsworthy event.
Mm-hmm. He's right? An event. It lets you know a lot about somebody's value system when they just call somebody's death like that a newsworthy event.
Right. So that suggests, I'm just going to leave it there. Amanda, yes, you should talk.
Miss Rice has asked me to communicate to the public that she has been in contact with Mr. Leonardo's attorney and that things have not gone well.
Okay.
And that the issues around artistic expression and the impact of it on her life, it seems like the artistic expression is winning in this case. And that further traumatizing of Miss Rice at the expense of her grieving process, at the expense of her having the opportunity to rebuild a legacy for Tamir through the Afrocentric Cultural Center to still care for her family.
Yeah.
And for this to be a battle that she is undergoing because one artist wants to keep a singular work in an exhibition it's disheartening. And it just shows how far society has to go in being anti-racist. That a brown individual would continue to inflict harm on this so that white people can look at the work and be empathetic. That's not the type of care that we need in this society where folks like George Floyd are being murdered. We are seeing how inhumane the murder is, and there isn't justice for Breonna Taylor. The justice is still not happening, even with the uprising. So
right.
It's certainly not going to happen by having these sterile images in museum spaces for people to look at. And I have to share that because it hurts me to know that the artist devalues Miss Rice and therefore devalues Tamir so much that he will not remove this work. And that Tamir is the brother of all of these other individuals. He needs to remove that too.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I want to know a little bit more about the Tamir Rice Afrocentric Cultural Center. Is it Cultural Center for Children? Is that the full title?
It's the Tamir Rice Afrocentric Cultural Center. Miss Rice, that is her conception and idea. I've assisted her in the process. The center is really about providing care after school programming and artistic expression for youth in the community. It's located in Cleveland's St. Clair neighborhood. That's a red line neighborhood. In totality, Cleveland's child poverty rate is about 50.5%. Mm-hmm. So the Afrocentric Center, in addition to providing music, dance, visual arts classes, Ms. Rice is adamant about having a political education as mm-hmm. well as providing things like food and aid to
the
people and their families in the community. She funded it through the settlement.
The settlement, right.
The city of Cleveland decided that instead of giving her justice, they would give her $6 million for the life of her son.
Mm-hmm.
Which is unquantifiable.
Of course.
But nevertheless, Miss Rice has a very big heart and is filled with a lot of pain. But even in carrying that grief, she continues to be selfless. And the selflessness is that I could take this settlement, which is the only thing I have left of my son.
Right.
And I could take my family and we could go somewhere and we could live comfortably and be away from the media. But no, I'm going to still continue to fight for Tamir. I'm going to continue to fight alongside other mothers. And I'm going to build this center because Cleveland systematically is excluding children from opportunity the way that they excluded Tamir from getting justice. And so she is continuing to be a leader when she is a victim. And that is the story of Black women from past to present, and it will be our future if things don't change for us.
Is there a website for that?
It's TamirERiceFoundation.org. Foundation also has social media pages, Instagram, Tamir Rice Foundation, and Facebook, Tamir Rice Foundation.
I would like to say that listeners can find out more about it there. It's well worth looking into. See for yourself. So LaTanya, can we talk about your show now?
Yeah.
I want to hear it done right.
You want to hear it done right?
Yes. We've got the museum doing things not in a way that you consider to have a scaffolding of care.
Yeah, Timaree Spaces Joy and Freedom is actually really different than most museum exhibitions, and it goes against actual institution that it's in, unfortunately and sadly, but you know, I'm really proud of it. So the show, it's really started, I read this discussion, and it's titled Temporary Spaces of Joy and Freedom. I came across it on Twitter in this discussion, like I said, between Leanne Batas and Saki Simpson and Dion Brand. I wasn't familiar with Leanne's scholarship at the time. It was Dion Brand. I had known her work. And so I, you know, just got immersed in it. When I started reading it, I was like, oh my God, this has got everything in it. It's such a strong discussion. And what I love about it is that, so Dion Brand is interviewing Leanne about her, Leanne's book that she has, As We Have Always Done, about Indigenous Radical Resistance. Leanne talks about her book is that she wrote her book for her community, Michisagi Anishinaabe community. She wasn't centering a white audience or white readers. So she uses a lot of words that are just, you know, they're the indigenous words, the words from her community. It was good to read a book that's centered from the perspective of her community and not trying to flatten things or water things down so that other people feel that their story is in here too in first. And she's like, no, I'm writing for my community. And what I love about Leanne's work is that she's seeing the connections between Black folks and indigenous communities and really seeing how when we have worked together and highlighting how we do not work together enough, and that and by working together, creating co-resistance, we could actually really protect ourselves, but also help bring down white supremacy. So reading her work is was just very exciting and cool to think about solidarity movement, really centering Black and Brown communities, centering Indigenous communities, and thinking, let's build things for ourselves. Let's find our history. So the discussion was really wonderful. And as I said, the expression scaffoldings of care is in there. It made me think about different artists who I have been admiring and could see connections with her discussion. Indigenous artists and Black artists have always been these people creating visions of freedom.
You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and streaming online at WPKN.org. This is Live Culture with Martha Willette Lewis, and this month I'm in conversation with artist and activist Amanda D. King and curator and activist LaTanya S. Autry. Please join us as we resume the conversation.
Then I started thinking about people I know, so that scaffoldings of care made me think about Trisha Hersey's work. Trisha does this thing called the Knapp Ministry, and it's one of her projects. She's a performance artist and does really just radical work and getting at the roots of issues and talking very much about fighting capitalism and grounding ourselves in our rest as a form of resistance and reparations, and thinking about Black care and always centering Black people in her work, but she's, you know, grounding her work in her community. So I thought about Trisha, and then I thought about my friend John Edmonds, this really cool photographer out in New York, and he has just wonderful work that's very proud of Black folks, of Black queer folks, this unapologetically Black kind of experience and just very strong kind of imagery and very beautiful and supple. And so included John in there. Leanne is an artist and does a lot of performance work and really is about the body and finding our strength is in our body and how we can live freedom. So it's not just things that we write and talk about, but that we live it, we embody it. And so I included a couple of videos that she's done in collaboration with other important Indigenous artists. We have the work she did with Amanda Strong, Bidabin, and Leeks, another video that she did, and Red Carpet by my friends Kyle Gowen and Moana Numatello. They're both of Decolonize This Place. And yeah, just the work is really strong. Their piece I like because it really brings together the concept of getting to co-resistance. It's a carpet, a floor cloth that's down the center of the gallery. And they talk about the land that we're on and helping people to remember and really not just think about it, but really to do the action of unsettling, right? To do that work of decolonizing. It's not just to learn a thing and then just continue to do things the same way, but it's actually about action, doing things, which is very much what Leanne talks about.
Is the museum in fact open now? And can I see the exhibit online?
There's pictures on the website. Right now we are closed because of COVID, and I am actually planning to do activities with some of the art objects, bringing them out into, you know, public spaces, like outside the museum. Almost all the artists in this show are activists, and their work is not really created necessarily to be part of an art world. It's work that's made to be out in the world with people. So it's in some ways odd for them to be in that space. As Kyle, when he was here, he said he felt like the red carpet was very lonely, having it be in that gallery, like by itself, right? The white cube. What's exciting is that Milana and Kyle given me permission to take the red carpet outside the museum, and we're going to be doing some actions with it in other spaces and thinking with it, you know. And I think that's what's great, like with Trisha's work, her, you know, once you encounter it, that sits in your brain and you keep thinking and then thinking about how to actually change your life, thinking with her practice and just thinking about how to keep that connection going. I'm seeing not so much about being in that room and having the artist's work be in dialogue, but introducing those pieces to more of the important actions happening here in Cleveland. So yeah, I think
the work on the road.
Yeah, what it always was doing before, because those activists are always just doing their work in places. It was great to have it in that space. Mm-hmm. But I think right now the work is to bring the art to the people and have them think with it and have it support whatever actions that they're doing.
That's a nice solution to this, because one of the problems with COVID, one of the huge problems with COVID is that it's incredibly isolating unless you have an endless supply of internet. And also it's not healthy to spend all of your time on the internet. So for you to bring it out on the road to people in different communities makes a lot of sense to me. And it's a better solution, I think.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about ways to connect with more of the activists and artists here in Cleveland and just communities who might not even really be thinking about art or doing important community-based work. And I think that the work, this In Temporary Spaces and Joy and Freedom, I actually believe has a lot of answers. That's why I got excited about that discussion that Leanne and Deanna are having and thinking about other artists. I am excited about it because I believe that they have answers for our time right now. I want to try to keep sharing that discussion with more people so that they know they also got a bigger network too. So it just increase our power as people who are fighting for, you know, real change in communities. It will increase our power, I believe. I do believe in that way that this art has that ability. We just need to get it to the people.
That transformative power. No, that's terrific. So Amanda, I wanted to just quickly talk with you about how COVID has impacted your practice or Shooting Without Bullets.
Certainly COVID has presented challenges for my organization, Shooting Without Bullets, the youth artists in Shooting Without Bullets, and the creative economy here in Cleveland in general.
Yeah.
We have a very fragile creative economy. So the cancellation of shows, the inability to make work at this time is affecting artists across the board. Many of our young artists are living in redline communities. And so virtual instruction is very difficult at this time. We have not been able to do that as much as we'd like to. But we also, a lot of people don't know, as an organization, although we are a very popular organization here in Cleveland, we have been around for 4 years and never secured a studio space because of funding. And so much of our work is guerrilla style. Much of our work is still done on the streets or in public spaces like libraries. You cannot develop your practice in a library. It's just not conducive. But I think that they're open and accessible spaces, and we're always grateful and thankful for that. So we have been able to convene in parks and in public spaces. And one of the strong suit in our creative portfolio is public art. And
right. So
we, Shooting Without Bullets, has a bunch of public art projects lined up. Some of them have been canceled and pushed back. So I'd say, you know, about 20% of them have, but we're looking forward to the 80% that are in negotiations now. We also have an exhibition coming up this fall at the Artist Archives of Western Reserve. It's a show entitled Bridges and Barriers. It's a group show.
That's an indoor space.
It's an indoor space. Okay. There will be some social distancing, obviously, and we'll have to rely heavily on virtual. But I wouldn't be telling the truth if I said that the anti-Blackness, even in this moment where everybody is releasing these statements of solidarity and the push for equity, I can't even get to creating some of this work because what is in my inbox is absolutely egregious. Institutions, the most prominent institutions in the city of Cleveland, I've had about all of them in my inbox this week. And none of the conversations have ended in anything constructive. It is ending in me educating them about why
their practices are harmful. So even when they reach out to me and say, I want to work with you, there is still anti-Blackness in that process. You want to work with me, but you want to pay pennies.
Right.
You want to pay pennies to my organization. But the reality is that we have a 50.5% child poverty. The reality is that statistics show that if you are closer to and more approximate to wealth as an artist, you will more likely make it in the art world. This is not about me being greedy. This is about if I want to create a truly thriving alternative arts ecosystem in which Black and Brown youth and young people are the designers of an anti-racist society and able to be a part of institutions if they so choose and to do the type of work that LaTanya is doing, we need resources. And you coming to us with a shoestring budget and a lot of demands is not working for me. And the fact that I have to use my labor to consult with you on why this is wrong and to help advocate for myself, but for the young people and other artists who may be fearful of negotiating or who may not have the time and the resources to continue to engage in these conversations, I am exhausted. So I am not even able to do the outward facing activism work at this moment because my inbox is a site of protests and resistance constantly. And I have seen Cleveland has a $9.1 billion creative economy. And yes, and it's time for true transformative change. Don't come to us because it's a hot moment right now. Don't come to us because you need representation as a Black and Brown artist. Come to us because you truly want to practice anti-racism, and that is difficult to navigate at this time.
That was really eloquently said. I want to thank you both so much for being on the show today. My guests today have been Amanda D. King, artist, activist, and creative director of Shooting Without Bullets.
And our website is shootingwithoutbullets.org.
Right. Thank you. And LaTanya Autry, who is the Gund Curatorial Fellow at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Cleveland, and her exhibit,
Temporary Spaces of Joy and Freedom. I'm also an activist and advocate, and I am also the co-producer of Museums Are Not Neutral. I was doing stuff way before I ever came to Cleveland to do this.
And Museums Are Not Neutral is a worldwide organization.
Me and my colleague, Mike Morawski, started it in 2017. It's been going strong. So I just want to put that out there. I've been doing this for a long time and in a very deep way.
So thank you both so much for being on Live Culture.
Thank you, Martha.
Thank you for listening to this month's Live Culture. Please join me again next month for another hour-long program of art and discussion. Bye-bye.
Support for WPKN comes from the Good News Restaurant and Bar at 694 Main Street South in Woodbury, Connecticut. Specializing in healthy and innovative cuisine, Chef Carol Peck has offered local farm-to-table food for 28 years. Open 5 days Wednesday through Sunday, continuous service from 11:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. with indoor and outdoor dining or takeaway. More information at goodnewsrestaurantandbar.com. In food, we trust.
Support for WPKN comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food and beverage products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Hello there. This is Marianne Sahalka, one of the many volunteers here at WPKN helping to keep the station open and relevant and not missing a beat. One of the things I love most about WPKN is the incredibly dedicated core of volunteers who are truly the soul of this place. Would you consider joining us and supporting this essential community resource by becoming a monthly donor? Any amount helps, but $15 a month gets you a subscription to either the New York Times or the Washington Post. A great way to support Voices of Truth during a time when we need it the most. Go to WPKN.org and press donate.
I'm United States Surgeon General Jerome Adams, America's doctor. And all across our nation, we've taken steps together to slow the spread of coronavirus. Now we must continue to take personal responsibility to protect ourselves and our loved ones. Because even though not all of us risk a severe case of coronavirus, we all risk getting it and spreading it to others, maybe without even realizing that we're sick. So if we want to get back to school, back to work, back to worship, and back to overall health, there are things our country needs to do. We need to follow state and local guidelines, take extra precautions if at higher risk, wash our hands frequently, stay 6 feet from others when we can, And when we can't stay 6 feet from others, please, I'm begging you, wear a face covering. These small actions will make a big difference. So I'm asking you to say it with me, America. Coronavirus stops with me. You can learn more at coronavirus.gov.
Produced by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services at taxpayer expense.
This period of quarantine has been especially difficult for individuals struggling with an addiction to alcohol. There continue to be many online and telephone AA meetings, and some groups have also started to meet again in person. In whichever form, there is a meeting taking place somewhere every hour of the day and night. Updated information is available at several online sites throughout our listening area. In Connecticut, listings of online meetings are available by going to ct-aa.org and clicking on Find a Meeting. You can also call 1-866-STEPS-12 or 1-866-783-7712. In the New York City area and Westchester County, the web address is nyintergroup.org. At this site, you can find telephone numbers or follow a link for online meetings. For Suffolk County meetings, the link is 2020.suffolkny-aa.org. And finally, listeners in other areas throughout the world can go to aa-intergroup.org. This site also lists meetings held in multiple languages.
The online marketplace is ever expanding, and so are the scams. The new online tool BBB AdTruth allows you to submit questionable ads for review. Not sure how to know if an ad is misleading or not? Well, BBB has a free AdTruth quiz to help you test your knowledge and steer clear of fraud. More information is available at bbb.org/AdTruth.
You're listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, independent community radio, broadcasting from the campus of the University of Bridgeport, also streaming at WPKN.org.
What a story